few announcements. I have project 2 graded. I'll hand it out at the end of the class. Next class, I'll hand out the exam. Okay. And I did put up a homework on the web page today, and it's due a week from today. So we typically do 4 homeworks, right? So this is going to be the third one. But I figured that we may just skip the last one, just have this one, and that'll be it. Okay, because the week after that, there is a project due. So I didn't want a homework and a project due at the same time. So I'm just going to skip the last homework. So we'll only have 3 homeworks. Then the one that I put out is the last one. Okay, and then the only things after that is the project and the final. Okay, final I already mentioned is a take-home final scheduled on the 22nd. Okay, so keep that in mind. So let's continue our discussion on some loose connection here. Let's continue the discussion on the web. So the place where we stopped was here. So I'm going to now, the rest of that lecture, which I'm going to talk about today, is on caching. Okay, caching in the context of the web. So here is a picture of a typical web proxy cache. Okay, so this is a client server, rather instead of a client server, this is a client proxy server architecture. So what happens in this case is the browser sends off a request. Okay, this request is basically arrives at a proxy rather than the real server. The proxy is assumed to maintain a cache. Okay, so it's going to look in the cache. The requested web page is already in the cache. You just get back a response. Otherwise, you will the proxy is going to fetch the web page from the server and deliver it back to you. Okay? That's the typical web proxy architecture. What is shown in this picture is something that is referred to as cooperative caching. Okay, so the typical picture is this browser, which is the client proxy, which has a cache, and then there is a server. Okay, so hits are serviced from the cache, misses are serviced by the server. Okay. In the notion or in the problem of cooperative caches, okay, what is assumed that there are many of these proxies, not just one, that are deployed. Each has a cache. Okay. In cooperative caching, what happens is if it's a miss at the proxy, rather than going to the server first, the proxy can actually ask neighboring caches, saying, do you have this web page? The answer is yes, then you actually fetch the page from a nearby proxy, put it in your cache and then send it back to the client. Okay? Only if the local nodes don't have, local or neighboring proxies don't have it, so you go to the origin server. Okay? So in other words, these proxies are cooperating with one another to service client requests. And this is referred to as cooperative caching. Okay? That's what is shown in this picture. So this is the local proxy. This is its cache. If it's a miss, so this is referred to as a local miss. Okay. Step 2 is you ask neighboring caches. So here are 2 neighboring caches saying, do you have it? Okay. If it is a miss in those caches as well, then this becomes what's called a global miss, meaning no one has the web page cached. In this case, you go to the server. Okay. So there's now this, when you have cooperative caching, you have this notion of a local as well as a global miss. Okay. So you have also a local hit and a remote hit. Local cache it and a remote cache it. So you can ask the question as to why do we want to do this? Okay, why not just when there is a miss here, go to the server? Okay, why should we ask neighboring caches? What benefit does this give us? Yes.
They could be closer and you don't want to make a bottleneck on the main server.
Yes. So first thing is they could be closer. Okay, you don't want to make the origin server a bottleneck. Okay, so if these are nearby caches, you can just ask them and get the request served quickly rather than going off to a far-off server. So it may still be faster to go to a nearby cache than to go to the server if these caches are close to this proxy. Okay, so it is potentially faster and it's potentially better from the server perspective because it still reduces the load on the server. Okay, if there is a global hit or a remote hit, rather, then the server doesn't have to be in the picture. Okay, any other advantages can think of? Cooperative caching, what does this buy you? Less updates, that's what you're saying. Yes, so in some sense, what has happened is that the cache effectively at this proxy now looks like a logical cache that is basically union of all of the caches. Okay, so in other words, even though this cache is small, the hit rate that you see here looks as if all of the objects that are cached in your neighboring proxies are also cached here. Okay, so the overall cache hit rate is going to go up because you are basically seeing the union of all the caches in this overall scheme. Okay, so yes, you have a question.
So how does the proxy node doesn't have the latest
version? Okay, so we'll come to cache. So your question is, how does the proxy node doesn't have the latest version? That's cache consistency. So we are going to look at three different approaches for cache consistency. So we haven't come to that. We are just looking at sharing caches. Okay, this is the whole problem of cooperative caching, is you're sharing the cache across proxies.
You mentioned that, by doing this, you don't update all the caches.
Right.
So, but you still have the other problem.
Yes. So cache consistency hasn't gone away. Okay, it's the problem. Whenever you have caching or replication, you will still have the problem of consistency. We'll see how to address that in just one moment. Okay, so just hold on for just a second. Is this clear what cooperative caches have bought you? You increase the cache hit rate effectively because the system as a whole behaves as if all of the objects are cached at a proxy. Okay, so if there are some objects that are cached there but not here, you still get the benefit. It's potentially faster because some of these proxies may be closer than the origin server, and it has the benefit of the higher cache hit rate also effectively means that the load on the server is less than if you did not have cooperative caching. Yes, question there.
It's saying that the cache hit rate is higher. I don't understand because you still have to make a remote access, remote requests. So, I don't see the advantage and the difference between the first point and the second point.
Okay, so when you say the cache hit rate is higher, so these proxies are behaving as if they are one logical cache, okay, although they're physically separate caches. Okay, so if you look at the overall cache hit rate, by cache hit rate, what we mean is if n requests come into the system and n prime requests go to the server, okay, the hit rate is basically n minus n prime. These are the number of hits over n. This is what we see as the cache hit rate. So you will still see that since there are some requests that are being served by remote caches, the overall number of requests that are going to the server is less than if you didn't have this. That's what we mean by hit rate in this case. So it is indeed true that to service what we call remote hits, you still have to make a request. Instead of going there, you're going to some other node. But the assumption is this node may be closer than the origin server. So that still gets you some benefit. Okay? Any questions here? Is this clear? What we just talked about? Now we'll see the manifestation of this in the context of a CDN, okay, in the content distribution network shortly. So now I'm going to talk about cache consistency issue. So to keep that in my perspective, this is the original picture, client-server architecture for the web. This is the picture we have. For now, let's just not assume cache consistency for just one moment, then we'll bring not cache consistency, cooperative caching. Let's just assume there's one cache. Okay? This is the browser, this is the cache, and there is a server. And let's ask the question as to how should this cache be made consistent with respect to the server. Okay? In reality, remember that this cache is going to have web pages from multiple servers, not just one server. Okay? Also, if you have cooperative caching, there are multiple proxies that cache content from one server. Okay? So the general problem of cache consistency is one where you have to talk to multiple servers. Each cache has to talk to multiple servers, and each server has to talk to multiple caches. But in the simplified version, there's only one cache and one server. Okay, and we'll see how to do this. Okay. So here are some characteristics of web pages to keep in mind as we talk about cache consistency. So why does this problem arise to begin with? So it arises because web pages do tend to be updated. Okay? So whenever you go and update a web page, be it the CNN homepage or New York Times or it's your own personal web page, anything that is cached by a cache somewhere is going to be invalid. It's a stale version of the page. Okay? If that cache continues to serve that page, then the users or the browsers are actually seeing outdated content. Okay? So what we want to ensure that any content that a cache is serving to the browser, okay, or the end users, is consistent with respect to the version at the server. Okay. So to understand this a little better, so if you look at how frequently web pages are updated, you will see that there is this bimodal distribution. Okay, there are some web pages that are infrequently updated or not at all. They're created but very infrequently updated. And there are many other web pages, okay, that are dynamic, which means that they are updated very frequently. Okay, so any news site, if you see CNN or New York Times, that web page actually changes every few minutes because there is this latest updates or the Reuters feeds or Associated Press feeds. Every few minutes, a news story appears there. Okay, so if you look at the last updated time of any of these pages, it's not going to be more than a few minutes from the current time. Okay? So these pages are very frequently updated. On the other hand, you may have your personal web page. You may update it once a week, once a month, maybe once a semester. So these are not frequently updated, okay, or maybe never. So you have these different types of pages, some that are updated frequently and some that are not. Okay, so you have this whole range of update frequency from few weeks all the way down to few minutes. Okay. Now the cache has to be consistent regardless of the update frequency, but it can take this characteristic into account to be smarter about how it actually goes and maintains consistency. Okay, so that's what we are going to look at next. So there are several approaches. Okay, there's one that's invalidate versus update and push versus pull that we are going to talk about. Okay, so let's look at so two dimensions, invalidate and updates and push versus pull, and I'm going to talk about all four data points. Okay. So in the push-based approach, okay, so here is the picture. In the push-based approach, the responsibility of cache consistency is on the server. Okay. In the pull-based approach, the responsibility of cache consistency comes on the proxy. Okay. So the canonical approach is very simple. The server tracks all proxies that have cached web pages from it. Okay. And if any web page is updated or modified, it has to notify that proxy saying the web page has changed. So that's why it's called a push-based approach. So here the web server is tracking which web pages are changing on it. Okay, and every time there's a change, it is going to send a message to any proxy anywhere that has cached a page from it, and specifically that page. And then you will say, tell that proxy that the page has changed. Okay. So there are two types of notifications you could send when a page changes. Okay, and this you can send what's called an invalidate notification, or you can send what's called an update notification. In the invalidate notification, you just send a message saying this web page has changed, so your whatever you have cached is invalid. Okay, discard it. This is called an invalidate. Okay, just indicates that an object has changed. In an update, you not only say that the page has changed, but you send the new version of the object. Okay, so you say here is the page has changed, and here is the new version of the page. Okay, you send that to the cache. Okay. So now you can ask the question, when would you use invalidates versus when would you use updates? What are the pros and cons? Yeah, so you can think about this a little bit. So why would you send an invalidate, or why would not always send updates? Let's ask that question. If the page has changed and somebody is caching it there somewhere, let's just send a new version of the page. Okay, yes. Yes. So invalidate is like a lazy update. You only tell the proxy that it has changed. And then beyond that, it's the proxy's job. If it wants that page from this point on, it has to get it from the server. Okay? In updates, you're actually forcibly sending the page out, regardless of whether the proxy wants it or not. Okay? So this should tell you several things. Okay? An update message is more expensive than an invalidate message. It's going to be larger. Okay? So it is going to consume more bandwidth. Okay? So if there are some proxies that don't want the page anymore, they cached it a long time back, they're not interested, meaning their users are not requesting the page. If you send an update, you're just wasted some bandwidth into sending the new version of the page, even though the proxy doesn't want it. Okay? The opposite is true for invalidates. Okay? In invalidates, what has happened is you're basically just told the cache that you don't need the page. Okay? If this page is popular at that proxy, okay, the proxy is immediately going to ask you for the new version of the page because some user is going to request it shortly thereafter. Okay? So then you have to, if the proxy comes back to the server and then the server sends back the page. Okay, so you have three messages going out. So invalidate came out, and the proxy is going to ask for the page, and then the page goes out. Okay, so if you know that the pages are popular, just pushing out the page using an update is far more efficient because in one message you just send the page. Okay, so for popular content, updates are better over invalidates because this is more efficient. Okay, if the content is not popular, okay, then invalidates are better, because you basically just tell the proxy that this is more efficient, that you just tell the proxy the page has changed, and if the proxy wants it, because this is not popular content, you don't know which proxy may request the page and which may not. By not popular content, we just mean that there are some users that are interested in it, but they are geographically spread out and you don't know who's going to request it next. By popular content, you mean there are lots of users requesting this page, so it's very likely that some user at this proxy is going to request the page. Okay? So typically, you send updates for more popular content and invalidates for not. The other thing one could do is also look at the frequency at which the page is changing and use that to decide whether to send invalidates or updates. So popularity is one metric to decide. So popularity also is related to the read rate. Okay, so this is the rate at which users are requesting the content or reading the content. The other thing, that the other metric that you can use to decide whether to send invalidates or update, is access, or rather update frequency. And this is basically the write rate. This is the rate at which you are writing to the page or updating the page. Okay, so you can either use the read frequency, which is the popularity, or the write frequency, which is also the update frequency, to decide. Okay. So one approach suggested here is you send updates for more frequently written objects, okay, and send invalidates for the rest. Okay, so object is very popular. Very frequently written, just send out updates because that's more efficient. And for other objects, you can send invalidates. Okay. So there are various methods, and we'll come back to this topic just in the next slide also. Okay, so first, let's look at, before I talk about pull, look at advantages and disadvantages. The main advantage of a push-based approach is it maintains tight consistency. Okay. Since it is the responsibility of the server to maintain consistency, and the server knows precisely when the object changes, it can send these messages out, whether they're invalidates or update, as soon as the object changes. Okay. So there will be no caches that have stale content as a result of this. Okay. So that means your tight consistency. Yeah, this is not strict consistency, but it's tight. Okay, so that basically minimizes that the probability of stale data being sent. Okay. And the proxies in this case can be passive or dumb. They don't have to have much intelligence because the server is doing all the hard work for them. Okay. The server is telling them when object changes and so on. Okay. Now the disadvantage is you are maintaining state at the server. Okay. The server in this case has become stateful. Okay. What state are we keeping here? Changing content, that's not necessarily state. That's
Who's changing and who's
stale? That you have to maintain anyway, right? Even if
which proxy is caching.
Right. So you have to keep track of which proxy is caching, not which pages are changing. Which pages, your content is your responsibility anyway, but you have to keep track of which proxy has the content, so you can only send these invalidates or updates to those proxies. So for every page on that server, you have to keep track of which proxies have it. Now there could be potentially thousands or tens of thousands of proxies that are deployed. You could deploy your own proxy on your machine. Okay? And if your proxy is cached somebody's content, that server now has to keep track of this fact and then has to send you invalidate or update messages. So, and you have to do this for every page because this is done on a per page basis. Right? If it's index.html versus business.html, you have two lists. Okay? So you could have a lot of state that is maintained. Yes. Yes, so this is a good point that you are bringing up, saying if server has to distinguish between a proxy and a browser, okay, so meaning an end client, because end client could just not use a proxy, you could directly go to the server. So that's true, but that can be done, because there are special tech protocol like internet cache protocol, which allows proxies to request data from the server. The server can know that this is a proxy. Okay, but you do have to distinguish between a proxy making a request and browser making a request. Okay. So you could have potentially a lot of state maintained at the server. This makes the server stateful. It puts more burden on the server. Okay. And HTTP by default is a stateless protocol. So you may have a stateless server, but if you add this method of consistency on top of HTTP, your server becomes stateful. Okay. And then the bigger other problem is the state may have to be maintained indefinitely. Okay. So long as a proxy is caching your page, you still have the responsibility of delivering invalidates or updates. Okay. You don't control for how long. In this case, you will not control how long the proxy is caching the page. Okay. The proxy may want to cache it for months, and you have to then every time the page is updated, you have to keep delivering either invalidates or update. Okay. So indefinite state, which is always bad. Okay. And then if the server crashes, and there are problems. Okay. In this case, we assume that the state can be kept on disk, so that's not a big deal. But if you keep it in memory for any reason, then some of the state is going to go away if the server crashes. Okay, so now the other approach is a pull-based approach. Okay, so in this case, everything is turned around. Okay, now the responsibility is now on the proxy to maintain consistency. Okay, and this is done by what is called a pull message. Okay. So the proxy can actually ask the server, has this page changed? Okay. And the server can say yes or no. Okay. Now this can be done in the context of HTTP itself. Okay. You don't even have to use any other protocol to do this, because although I didn't mention this clearly last time, if you look at the HTTP protocol, there's something called a GET request, which is what we talked about last time. This just so you could just say GET index.html, and this is just going to retrieve index.html for you. Okay. There is also a version of GET which is called a conditional GET. Okay. So this is what is called also if modified since message. So you have a GET message. So this says GET index.html, and then you can add a condition saying if modified since, and you specify a time. So this is what is called a conditional GET. So it's only going to get the page if it has changed since this time. Okay. In a normal GET, you always ask for the page. In a if modified since, or what's called an IMS GET, you will also specify a time. So if it has changed since this time, send it to me. Otherwise, I have it. So proxies can then use this to poll, saying when you send the poll, you just send a if modified since tag with the GET message. And the server will send it to you only if it has changed since that point in time. Yes,
so
question.
It's just basically to have less messages or less data coming back?
Right. So the point, when you would you choose this, right? If you already cached index.html in this example here, you retrieved it at some point. Okay, so let's say you retrieved it at 10 a.m. today. Okay. Now you want to see if the page has changed. If it hasn't changed, you don't want to get the same page again. That's wasteful. Okay. So you will do a GET and you will say if modified since 10 a.m. So then the server is going to send the new page to you only if it has changed since 10 a.m. Okay, if there's you look at the update time on the file. Okay, if it says that the file was updated at 11 a.m., then this is a new version of the page, so it's going to send it. If it shows that the last update was at 9 a.m., and if modified since thing says 10 a.m., so it's not going to send the page in this case. It will just say you have the latest version. So you just get an OK back from the server instead of the page. Okay, so you can do this IMS HTTP messages, okay, in order to do this polling. Okay, so this can work without any additional protocol. You're just using HTTP to conditionally retrieve content. Okay. Now the big question here is, when should you do this polling? Okay, that is what is going to give you some consistency guarantees. Okay. So there are various techniques that could be used. Okay, the one that is most commonly used, okay, is one that is called TTL. Okay, so whenever the server sends back a page, okay, if you do get or conditional get, it always assigns an expiration time to the page. Okay. Now this expiration time could be set any way the server wants. The server has full control, it can decide whatever it wants. Okay. So it could send expiration time of 1 day, 1 minute, it can use whatever it thinks. So if the server has some notion of how frequently the page is changing, it can set an appropriate expiration time. So if it believes that the page is changing once an hour approximately, let's say, it could set an expiration time of 1 hour. Okay? That is referred to as a time to live value, which is the page is live or assumed to be up to date for an hour. Okay? So if these expiration times are embedded in the page, the proxy has this when it retrieves the page. So it can see, has the TTL expired or not. If the TTL has expired, it will poll the server. If it has not expired, it's assuming that the content is fresh. Okay? So this is the most common approach that is used. Okay? Now notice that this doesn't give you any guarantees. Okay? Server can put whatever expiration time it wants, okay? But it's not guaranteeing that the page is not changed. Server, let's say, is saying it's going to expire in an hour, the content owner comes and updates the page. Okay? So now all proxies have stale content. Yeah, because they will assume that the page is still valid for the next 1 hour, but it got updated shortly after the page was retrieved. Okay. So although this is the most commonly used approach by web proxies, it only gives you weak consistency guarantees. Okay. It doesn't really give you any guarantee. All it is saying is, if the server intelligently assigned its expiration time, which ensures that the page actually hasn't changed so long as it hasn't expired, then whatever you have cached is good, but there's no guess. Server doesn't make a guarantee. It's only making a guess on the expiration times.
So why can't client make guesses? I understand server has more information.
Right. So you'll come to client making guesses in just there are several approaches. So here, there's the server is assigning this expiration time. Okay. So the polling frequency, when to poll, depends solely on whenever the page expires, based on whatever the server has said. Okay. At that point, you poll and you find out, has the page really changed? It has expired in my cache, but has it changed? Okay. If it doesn't change, then you still continue to use the page with the new expiration time. Or if it has changed, you get the new content. Okay. That's what you would do here. Okay. Now you ask this question about client or the proxy trying to figure this out. So that is the other approach. Okay, now if you figure out that the server is sending you bad expiration time, or the server may not even send an expiration time. It's not guaranteed that every server is going to send expiration time. Okay, when you put up your web page, the server really has no idea when you update it next. Okay, so you may have configured some default expiration time in Apache, saying every time some page is retrieved, just put 1 hour or 1 day. Okay, so it's just sending this value without any real intelligence. Is because the administrator configured it that way. Servers could be more intelligent. They could actually track update frequency by looking at when the pages are updated and send this value in a more intelligent way, but most servers will not do that. Okay. So now, if that's the case, then you can say, let's put more intelligence at the proxy. Let it figure out how frequently the page is changing. Okay. So what the proxy can do is, it can keep polling the server, okay, so, and then figure out, based on what responses it is getting, how frequently the page changes. Okay, so you can start. So here, this what is shown here, what the technique that's shown here is basically an adaptive approach. So you start with a conservative poll frequency. So whenever you retrieve a new page and you put it in the cache, you will start polling, let's say, once every 5 minutes. Okay, so 5 minutes after you retrieved it, you will poll the server, has the page changed? Maybe the server will say yes if it is frequently updated, or maybe it says no. Let's assume it says no. So if it says no, then you say, okay, I tried 5 minutes, and let me now be a little more less aggressive, and I will now poll after 10 minutes. Okay, so 10 minutes later, you send another poll. Okay, at that point, maybe it says no. Okay, so then you poll after maybe 20, or you keep increasing this duration until you find a time when the page actually changed. Okay. So suppose it changed 2 hours later. So now you know that from the time you retrieved, it was actually changed 2 hours later. Okay, so this gives you some idea of how frequently the page is changing. So then you can set the update frequency to be 2 hours. Okay? So now you poll after 2 hours in this case. So assume the page actually changed 1 hour later, not 2 hours later. So when you poll 2 hours later, you'll get back a message saying the page has changed. Okay, so now you say the first time it changed after 2 hours, next time when I polled it had already changed, so maybe 2 hours is not the right frequency. So you will actually reduce the update frequency and say, now let me try 1 hour. Okay, so you have it. So you keep polling at different frequencies to actually figure out what is the rate at which the page is changing. But typically, the page doesn't change at some set frequency. It is changing at some arbitrary frequency. Right? It changes whenever the content owner changes it. But the assumption is there are pages that are going to change frequently, and there is some update rate that is reasonable for those pages. Right? Like CNN, its good assumption is 2 minutes or 1 minute because it does change that frequently. Okay, your web page may be once every 3 days. Like the class page changes every 2 times a week, right? That's the update frequency because I put up notes 2 times a week. Okay, so this is not by design. It is just that you observe over a period of time, you'll observe that it changes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. It could change on other days as well, but that's the pattern that you observe. So you're probing the server to discover the pattern. Okay, and then you set the poll frequency to whatever pattern you have discovered. And maybe the pattern changes, and then you observe that next time you poll at that frequency, I'm getting something completely different. So you rediscover by the same mechanism. Okay? So this is referred to as intelligent polling by the proxy, where it is trying to discover some patterns and using some values that seem reasonable for those patterns. Okay, so that gives you this poll frequency. So here there is no burden on the server. The page can change whenever it wants. The proxy is adapting its polling frequency to the right frequency of the page. And as the right frequency changes, it will readapt. It is discovering these characteristics. So assumption is there are no prior knowledge of object characteristics. The polling method is going to adapt itself to whatever the update is observing on the page. Okay? So these are the two approaches. One is you just use server expiration time. In other case, you observe, and based on whatever you're observing, you choose reasonable polling frequency. Okay, so these are two pull-based approaches. Now, I should mention here that if you use a pull-based approach, it is possible to maintain strict consistency for every request. Okay, how would you do this? That you guarantee that no stale content is ever served.
No.
So you could, in theory, ensure strict consistency, which says every time a request arrives at the cache, you first send the IMS request saying, I have it cached, has it changed? Okay, so then if the answer is no, you just send back the response. If the answer is yes, you retrieve the new code. This will ensure that you will never serve stale content. Okay. But it also ensures that the latency of a cache hit has gone up because you are actually asking the server every time it's a cache hit, saying, I'm about to serve this, has it changed or not?
There is no cache hit.
If it hasn't changed, you will not actually retrieve a large page, right? So if it is a 64 kilobyte image or some such thing, you're just sending us a few bytes and getting back a few bytes. So you don't have the latency of large object retrievals. Yeah, but there is a round trip latency as I'm gone on. Okay, so you could guarantee strict consistency, but as I said, there are downsides to it, so that's something to keep in mind. Are we not assuming time synchronization? We don't really assume time synchronization. Of course, you have to understand expiration times and so on. Okay, so these could always be sent in UTC, universal time, because if you're talking to a server in Europe, if it says midnight, that's not your midnight, right? So you will assume that you know time zones and so on. But that's taken care of. The protocols already translate across dates and so on. Okay? But roughly, you have to assume that your clocks are all synchronized somewhere. Otherwise, if your clock is totally off, this doesn't work. Okay? But that's there in all of these protocols. Okay. So advantages, disadvantages. So you'll see it's the exact opposite of push-based approach. So here, it can work in the context of HTTP, no additional protocols needed. Server is stateless, server is not doing anything. Okay. Resilient to proxy and server failures because it's very simple, don't have to keep any state. Okay. Typically, the consistency guarantees are weaker, especially if you use expiration time. And typically, the object will change between any two poles. Right? So you don't know exactly when the object changes. You discover it between two pole messages. So from the time the object changed to the time that you have the next pole, any request that you have serviced will see stale content. Okay? So in the server push case, as soon as the object changed, the message was sent. So you knew exactly when it changed. Here you only know it at the next polling time. Okay? Between that object changing and the next poll that you make, you will so keep serving stale content. Okay? I already mentioned you could do strong consistency. Okay? And there is higher message overhead here than the push case. In the push case, you just only send messages when the object changes. Here, you may be polling more frequently than you need. They are effectively wasted messages. You didn't have to do it, but you don't know. So you are polling the server, and server may keep saying no to every IMS, saying nothing has changed. So you wasted some messages. Okay, so the overhead is higher in this case. Okay? But servers remain unchanged. You could put an Apache server, and some proxy that implements any of these approaches will interoperate. So you don't have to change the protocol. It doesn't assume anything on the server end. Okay, so it works with any server. Okay. So third approach is what is a hybrid of these two. Okay, and it's called a leases approach. Now this technique by itself has nothing really to do with the web. Okay, this leases approach has actually been used widely in distributed systems. Okay, it's been adapted to web caching as well. Okay, so keep that in mind that this is a more widely used approach in the context of distributed systems than just this. Okay. So what does this do? Okay. So what is a lease? Let's define what a lease is. So lease is simply a duration of time, okay, for which the server agrees to notify the proxy of any modification. So it's a contract between the server and the proxy. It has a time duration. And what the server agrees is, for this much time, I will notify you if the object changes. Once the lease expires, the server has no longer any responsibility to notify the server. Okay? So it is, in some sense, a server push approach, but with some time constraints that are associated with it, and they are basically specified in the lease. Okay? So here is how it works. So whenever the first time the proxy has, so here is the picture. So the client has issued a read for a page. Okay, let's assume it's a cache miss here. So here you send a GET, HTTP GET, and then you also request a lease from the server. Okay? The server sends back a reply, and it sends a lease which says, I will notify you if this page changes for this much time. For the next 3 hours, if the page changes, I'll notify you. Okay? So now the proxy can just keep serving requests because the server has said that it is going to be notified if the object changes. So it doesn't have to do any IMS or anything like that. Okay, so it can keep servicing requests with the assurance that the content is fresh. Okay, because so long as the lease is valid, and you are guaranteed to get some notification. So now if the lease is valid and the object changes, the server has to send any invalidate or update like the push-based approach. Okay, so everything that we talked about, the push-based approach still holds you. Okay, except that once the lease expires, you don't have to do this. You can throw the state away. Meaning the server doesn't have to keep any state of the proxy anymore. Okay, is this clear? Now, if the lease expires, now it's the responsibility of the proxy to decide whether it wants to renew the lease or get a new lease. Okay, and that it can do intelligently. If it is continuing to see requests for that page, it can say, let me get a new lease or let me renew the lease. If the object is no longer popular, okay, maybe it was some popular object but now nobody is accessing it, it just lets the lease expire and wait for the next request, which may come 2 days later or may never come. Okay? So it's the proxy's job to figure out whenever leases expire what to do. Should it renew the lease or not renew the lease? Okay? And it can decide that based on the local popularity of that page at that proxy. Okay? Is this clear? Yes. So lease is not a part of the protocol. It's a separate thing that has been proposed to, but it's not part of it. it has been integrated in some other protocol, but it's not part of HTTP. So server has to understand what a lease is. Now, leases are, as I mentioned, widely used. So whenever you do DHCP, for example, you get an IP address. You get a lease with that IP address. So if you actually look at the DHCP protocol, it's a renew lease. It's effectively what the server has done, as it has given you an address and said it's going to expire at this time. Yeah, until then you have this address. When the lease expires, the client has to renew the IP address. Otherwise, the IP address may be given to someone else. Yeah. Similar things are true here. Now, the interesting thing here is the duration of the lease allows you to control lots of interesting things. So, longer leases means the server has to keep more state. Okay. Short leases means the server can throw away state as soon as the lease expires. So, you can control the amount of state that is kept at the server by deciding the duration of the lease. Okay. In particular, if the lease duration is set to infinity, okay, this just becomes a pure server push approach. That's what the server push approach is. Whenever anybody requests the page, you have to keep sending it, invalidates or updates. Okay? If the lease duration is set to zero, okay, this becomes a pure pull approach because it's basically the lease comes back and it expires. So then you have to basically ask for the lease again or pull, saying using IMS and say give me a new lease. Okay? So the two extremes of the lease duration, which is zero duration, just basically boils down to pulling. Infinite duration is server push, but anything in between gives you something reasonable that has some advantages of either approach. Okay, so you don't have to keep indefinite state, so that's good, so you can control the amount of state, but there is some responsibility on the proxy as well. So if the page is no longer popular, server doesn't have to do wasteful work and so on. Yes.
Right. If it is at the page level, the component would have changed actually, for example.
Okay. So you are asking a question which we have not really talked about here, which is dynamic content. Okay. So here all of the assumption was the pages are static, meaning that it's an HTML page that's stored on the file system. Okay. Now, this is not always true. A large fraction of the pages are generated on the fly, not stored anywhere on the file system. Okay, the server is going to, let's say it's a PHP generated page, the server is going to generate this page on the fly, okay, and customize it based on the user request. So Amazon, for example, when you go to Amazon, it actually makes a version of the page for you based on what you have bought in the past. It may actually have a cookie that recognizes you, embeds your page in there, name in there, saying welcome, and it will put your name in there. So if someone else goes there, they get a different page. So these types of pages, since they are dynamically generated on the fly, typically the server, when it sends this page, it puts a do not cache tag in there. Okay, so dynamic content is typically not cached at the proxy, okay, because the page is always generated on the fly. So it's assumed that the next time it's generated, the page may change. So dynamic HTTP content, or HTML rather, content, you never cache because the server already embeds the thing in the request saying do not cache. Okay. So all this only works for static content, okay, which is also a disadvantage because more and more content is generated dynamically these days. Okay. Any website that is popular will have some form of customization, okay, of the page that basically says the page is dynamic, not static. Okay. So now there are other techniques we'll talk about where fragments of the dynamic page may be static and you could cache the fragment. We will not talk about them right now. Okay, let's just finish the discussion here. Okay. So here are three ways. So I talked about this lease duration. How do you choose it? Right. So there are three ways to choose it. It's called age-based lease, okay, renewal frequency-based, or server load-based. Okay. So here in the first approach, the lease duration is made proportional to the age of the lease, to the age of the object. The age of the object is basically when did it change last? Okay, that's the age. So infrequently changing objects have large ages because that's the time it was last modified. Frequently changing objects are short ages. Okay, so if the lifetime of the object is longer, the lease can be also longer. Okay, so if the page is not changing, you can afford to give a long lease because you know you don't have to do much work. Right? So you can keep that state for a long period of time. Now the renewal frequency basically says I make the lease duration proportional to the popularity of the page. If the page is popular, I try to give it better guarantees. Okay, because it's frequently accessed, you don't want to serve stale content. So if you see that the popularity of certain pages are high on that server, you can make leases longer and say I'm going to give better guarantees for that page. Okay. And the server load base says that I make the lease duration proportional to the current load on the server. Okay, if the load is high, yeah, you can make the lease shorter. That allows you to throw out the state faster and it basically reduces your burden. Because if you have a lease, you have to service all of the proxies that hold valid leases, send invalid. That increases the burden. So if I have high load, I can reduce my burden by making leases shorter. Okay? That reduces the work I have to do. Yes.
How does the lease handle the
server crashes? The server crashes. How does the lease? So typically, so if you keep the lease state in memory, you have the same problem that this is not resilient to the server failures. You keep the lease state on disk, then you can certainly do that, right? Or keep it in a database. Now some of it is actually kept in memory, in which case it is not resilient at all. So that's the same problem as any stateful server. If you have a stateful server and you have memory state, this crashes are going to cause trouble.
How is the lease state less than
Right. So the question is, how does the state that the server have to maintain reduce when you have leases as opposed to the push case? Right? So in the push case, the server never knows when to stop sending messages. Okay? As soon as a proxy caches the page, it perpetually it has to send perpetual messages because it doesn't know when the proxy actually throws out. Okay? Here you can control that information. Okay? So in a server push case, the table of proxies that you have to keep contacting may keep growing indefinitely. Okay? In this case, if you give a 1 hour lease, that is bounded by the number of requests you would receive in that hour.
So for a popular page, you would expect that?
Yes. So in a popular page, the state will still be higher. Okay? But you could also control the amount of state by controlling the lease duration. That's what we were just talking about here. So in the for a popular page, if you don't want to do more work, you can always give shorter leases. Or you could say this is popular, so I try to give better guarantees, so I pay the price of keeping this state. So it can be controlled and by the server. Yes.
Is the lease duration decided by the server or by the
proxy? So is the lease duration decided by the server? It's always decided by the server because the server is the one issuing the lease. The proxy doesn't control anything there. It can only request the lease. Okay, and then you decide on the duration. This case. Any other questions here? Okay. So now we'll come back to cooperative caching. So far the picture that we had was one proxy, one server, and how to maintain consistency. So now if you have come back to this problem of cooperative caching, there are multiple proxies and you have to maintain consistency. And how do you go about doing this in this context? So let me show first cooperative caching in the context of a hierarchy, and then we'll talk about some consistency techniques and so on. Okay, so here what we have at the very bottom in this picture are some clients. Okay, here are some proxies. These are proxies that are deployed close to clients. Okay, now if you have a large number of these, okay, typically what is done is you have a hierarchy of these caches, where you have leaf caches and your parent caches. So this is a one level hierarchy, but you can have arbitrary levels. Okay, and the server is at the very top. Okay, so now there are many systems like the Squid proxy cache, okay, which is an open source proxy cache. Like Apache is an open source web server, Squid is an open source proxy cache that employs a hierarchical architecture. Okay, so now how does this work in the context of a hierarchy? Okay, so here is a read request that is made by that browser to that client. Okay, so we'll assume that it is a miss. So if it is a miss, then you basically ask your, this is cooperative caching. So you are going to see, do other proxies that are close to me, do they have the object, right? So you send these messages, it's called ICP messages, Internet Cache Protocol, and that's what ICP stands for. So you send this to your two peers as well as to your parent. Okay? So in this case, let's assume So they will all reply whether they have the object or not. So let's assume none of them has the object. This is called a global miss. Okay. So then you will forward this request to the parent. Okay, and the parent is going to recur. If this was a multi-level hierarchy, the parent would send to its peers and its parent. Okay, because this could be a large tree and this will repeat until you actually discover some proxy that either has the content or then nobody has the content. So in this case, let's suppose the parent doesn't have it. That we know because the parent said no. So in this case, it will be a miss at the parent. So parent is going to send the HTTP request to the server, get the page. Okay, and then it's going to trickle down to the parent. From the parent, it comes to the leaf cache. And from the leaf cache, it comes back to the browser.
So a cache miss is very expensive.
Yes. So we'll come to that in a moment. So cache miss is expensive, global miss. Okay, so if this was a long hierarchy, so advantage is if since it's doing cooperative caching, if somebody up the tree has the page, you will get it without going to the server. Okay, so you get all the benefits of cooperative caching. But as was just mentioned, the disadvantage is if it's a global miss, it takes a long time for the system to discover nobody has it. Okay, and then you have to go to the server, retrieve it, and it will trickle down. Okay, so that's a problem with this approach. Okay. So here is another approach that also uses cooperative caching, but gets rid of this problem of global miss is expensive. Okay. So here what happens is, in the previous case, okay, so the important difference between the two approaches, in the previous case, the local cache, local proxy knows what is in its cache. It knows nothing about what is in peer caches or the parent. It always sends ICP messages, with effectively polls, saying, do you have this object or not? Okay, so it's discovering what other caches have by asking them on demand. Okay. So the next approach is one where you actually keep a directory of not only what you have, but what you believe your neighbors have. Okay, so here is a directory that basically just shows one entry in the directory. Let's say I have X, or rather node A has X. So let's do the same thing here and see what happens. Okay, so here is the read for A. Okay. So it assumes that again it's a local miss. Okay. So if it's a local miss, then you do a local directory lookup which says, who do I believe has it? Okay, so here is a directory entry that says page A is cached by proxy X or node X, which is right here. Okay, so what you do is when you get this directory hit, you will just send a request directly to that node and say get A. Okay, so assume that the node still has it. So you get back the content and then you send it down. Okay. So in this case, if nobody has it, the directory lookup will end up with a null result saying I don't think anybody has it. So you will just send get the request directly or serve the request directly from the server. So you don't have the discovery mechanism where you will just have this object or request trickle up the tree. Okay. So lookup is always local. Okay. Hits are at most two hops. If there's anyone has it, okay, you will get it in two hops without having to send all these messages to figure out who has it. Okay. And misses are also at most two hops. Okay, because the worst case that is, the best case is you do local miss, look up the directory, nobody has it, you go to the server. Okay. But you could be wrong. Okay. You may have a stale directory entry because now we have the problem of keeping the directory up to date. So you may assume that X has it. You send this request to X, but X has just discarded the page for whatever reason. This is a cache, right? So it can do cache replacement where new objects come in, it throws out other objects from the cache. So you send the request here and you find that node X has just discarded the page. So this is basically an incorrect request. So you have a wrong hint. Okay? So then you have to go to the server. So you have this one extra hop if your what is in your directory is not up to date. Okay? So maintaining a directory significantly improves the performance of cooperative cache. Okay? But you have the problem of maintaining the accuracy of the directory, which means every time any of these nodes fetches a page, you have to broadcast a directory update saying, I now have this page, so all of these nodes can update directory entries. Also, when you discard a page from your cache because it may have been invalidated for whatever reason, you again have to broadcast saying, I have discarded the page from my cache. Okay, so all of this has to be done. So metadata maintenance, which is the directory updates, become the sort of problematic or more expensive in this case.
Plus you have more state, right?
So proxies also have to maintain state, because the directory is effectively state of what other caches have. But this could be a directory state. It could be a database, for example. You could just look up in a database saying who has this page. Okay. Now, there could be multiple directory entries for a page. That should be clear, because the page may be in multiple caches. So in this case, it was in X. It has appeared also in Y's cache. So Y is going to broadcast a directory update. So these two nodes will have two entries for A, say X has it and Y has it. Okay. So if you have multiple entries in the directory and somebody requests the page, you have to decide which proxy to go to. So you could decide on going to a nearby proxy or pick one at random or so. Any of these approaches would work. Okay. So this is basically the miss case where you just read B, you look up the directory, there's nothing. You just go get it from the server and then you service the request, and then you have to send the directory update, which I have not shown there. So the early work on cooperative proxy caching was first started with one proxy cache. You deploy your proxy cache, improve performance. Then people started saying, let's do cooperative caching. When there are multiple caches, let them share their caches. Okay. This eventually led to what are called content distribution networks, which is the same thing, but now with a slightly different twist. So in the CDN, we talked about CDN some time back. If you remember when we did naming, we talked about this. Right? So the CDN basically is a cluster of proxies that are deployed everywhere. Okay? And the CDN operator takes responsibility of caching some content and redirecting user requests to the closest content, the closest proxy that has the content. Okay? So we looked at the Akamai approach, which is a DNS-based approach. When you did DNS, if you remember, I showed you the Intel, we looked up this Intel.com, and it actually resolved to a local machine. Right. Does anyone remember this?
Yeah.
Right. So what happens in this CDN is whenever you do a lookup, it's doing a DNS lookup to figure out where the request is coming from, and it sends you to the nearest proxy. So then the browser actually contacts that proxy. And then that proxy has to serve the page. So it could use cooperative caching. It's not guaranteed that the proxy has the page. You're just sending the request to a nearest proxy. So if it has the page, it will actually send the page to you. Otherwise, it will do something equivalent to a directory lookup, saying who has the page. Is there another proxy somewhere close by? And it will basically get it from there or get it from the server. Okay. Now, again, cache consistency is an issue in the context of CDN. So what happens typically is there a hierarchy is maintained. So here is your server. Okay, so these are proxies that are maintained by the CDN, and this is a hierarchy. But this hierarchy is only used for metadata propagating invalid data and update. So what happens is the server doesn't have to keep track of which, in this case, which proxies are caching it. The CDN keeps track of it. So in this case, the root proxy keeps track of which of these proxies have the CNN homepage, for example. So let's assume this proxy has it and this proxy has it. This is tracked by this proxy. Okay. So the server doesn't need to know any of this. Okay. So this proxy is going to keep polling the server. Or basically, if the server wants to send out a notification, it only sends it to the root proxy saying, my home page has changed, figure out which proxies have it and notify them. Okay, so it is just going to send a message down, or this proxy can keep polling. Okay, so the server push or the client proxy pull only works between the main server and the root of the hierarchy, not the rest. Okay. And once this proxy knows the page has changed, since it keeps track of which proxies have the object, it will send notifications, updates, or invalidates to the right set of proxies. Right? And this is important because most CDNs have tens of thousands of nodes. Okay? The Akamai CDN has several tens of thousands, maybe 30,000 or 40,000 at last count. So the server cannot keep track of which of these 40,000 nodes have my page. it would just be problematic. So this is done by the CDN itself. Okay, so there's only a designated node that the server has to talk to, and that node takes care of the rest. Okay, so that is basically what is maintained here. Now that node can multicast the notification out, or it could use some other approach. That's left to it, but in most cases you multicast it out to the right set of proxies. Okay. So that's the thing to keep in mind. This is still an active area of research, so there are a lot of people still working on variety of problems in this case. Right? So here is the same Akamai CDN picture that we have already looked at. Right? So the client is here. Okay, so this basically gets the base document from the origin server. Okay? The origin server basically sends a document with references to embedded document. Okay? These embedded documents are served from the Akamai DNS. That's the way it works. So your browser doesn't have to know where a proxy cache is. It just gets the initial index.html. All of the images in there, for example, may resolve to a proxy in the CDN. Okay, so in this case, you basically get the page with embedded documents. And then when you do DNS lookup for those documents, go to the Akamai CDN server, it then sends you to a cache. Okay? So this is a server, but this is really a proxy server. So all the embedded documents are actually gotten from the proxy. Okay? So the assumption is the embedded documents or images are the heavy duty things that the server does. So getting them from the proxy is much faster. Okay? The HTML page is pretty short, so that the server can serve. So that's the way this basically works. Any questions here on CDNs? Alright, so the last thing I'm going to talk about is how CDNs are evolving. Okay, this was the problem that was mentioned of dynamic pages, right? So any proxy caching mechanism, be it a CDN or a cooperative caching, none of them work if the page is generated on the fly, because the server basically sends back a tag that says this page was dynamically generated, don't cache it. So all of the techniques just become useless if your server is doing dynamic content generation, which is true for a large fraction of servers today. Anything that is sophisticated is going to use some form of dynamic content generation. So what do we do to address this issue? How can we bring in proxy servers and have them help even if the page is generated dynamically? Okay? So there are many approaches. Okay, I will talk about two, one that is shown on this slide and the second approach. So one is to cache static fragments of a page, but not the whole page. Okay, so if you take any page, okay, so let's assume this is Amazon page. Okay, so if you think about the page has multiple parts, right? So here is the Amazon logo. Okay, then it may say welcome, and it may put your name here, Prashant, or something like that. Okay. And then here there may be an image saying this is a shopping cart, okay, cart content. Then there is some sidebar here with categories, or maybe at the top saying books, music, and so on. And then there may be some message here. Okay. And then there may be some copyright notice down there. Okay, now if you analyze this page, you will see that although the page itself is generated on the fly and pieces are customized based on users, there are parts of the page that are common to all requests. Like the Amazon logo is going to be sent to everyone. That is not going to change based on users. The copyright notice is going to stay there. Okay? Maybe the tabs that say books, music is common to everyone. What may be different is this welcome and the username, and then maybe there may be a list of items that are shown based on your browsing patterns. That may be customized. Okay? So this part may change, this part may change, but these other things may be static. Okay? So you can then think of scenarios where the static parts are actually cached at proxies. The Amazon logo, which is a GIF image, can be cached. And that can be served from the cache. It's not going to change. Okay? So what people have done is whenever you have this dynamic content generation, they have employed techniques called fragment caching. Fragment caching basically caches parts of a page rather than the whole page. By definition, we assume when you cache a page, you cache everything. Okay? This only caches fragments of it, and then the others are actually sent from the server. Okay? So in this case, you would cache all the static parts, but the ones that actually change are fetched by the server. So So that still reduces the load on the server by only sending what is needed from the server and caching the rest. Okay, those are the first set of techniques. What is shown in this picture is basically then what is being done now in by many researchers and also by Akamai CDN, where you put more intelligence at the proxy, so the proxy can do better stuff. Right. So here, what is shown is that's the server and that's the database at the server. So you actually cache some database content at the proxy. Okay, so the proxy is no longer a simple web proxy. It has become a more intelligent proxy where it can execute code on behalf of the server. Okay. Simple example is you can put your book catalog. Okay, take the entire database of your book catalog and cache it at the proxy. The assumption is the catalog is not going to change frequently. Maybe you update it once a day when new items arrive or some such thing. Okay. So in this case, what the client requests is partially serviced by the proxy itself, because if you're just doing a search query, you can just serve it from your catalog and you can send back the request. Okay. Now if you're doing buys, then you have to still send it to the server, because you're not going to process transactions that require server intervention. But simple things can be offloaded to the proxy, simple computations that the server was doing. Okay, so this is another way by which proxies can help. Okay, the first approach was you do cache fragments. The second approach, you actually move some of the simpler processing from the server to the proxy and a proxy do it. Okay, the more complex processing is still done by the server, but simple things that you know will work okay, you can send sort of offload to proxy. So these are also referred to as edge servers. They are no longer proxies. They are actually servers that are deployed at the edge of the network, close to the clients, that are doing some intelligent processing, not acting as mere caches, but actually doing processing on behalf of the server. Okay, is this clear? Sorry?
Storing the content,
right.
The copyrighted content of the...
Yeah, so in this case, if you do this, you have to have a contract with the CDN, where CDN agrees to keep, actually have a copy of your database, runs a database engine and make sure that, you know, it doesn't give the content away. So it's not done, you just don't download a database and start serving it. But it doesn't work in this case. Okay. So we have 5 minutes. I'm going to introduce the next topic and then we'll stop there. Okay. So the next topic is basically distributed objects. So we have done some of this already. When we did RMIs, we looked at how do you do object-oriented programming and remote methods and so on. So now we look at the same topic in a lot more detail, okay, in the context of distributed objects. And this is basically going to be case studies rather than looking at principles which we already know when we did RMIs. We'll just see how those principles are instantiated in two cases. Okay, one is Java EJBs or Enterprise Java Beans, and the other one is Scorba. Okay, both are systems that use distributed objects, okay, and use are sort of RMI-like. So this is the picture that we looked at when we did, I think it was chapter 4, okay, when we did RMIs. So there's a client and there is a server. Okay. The server is implemented as an object, so this is object-oriented world. So any object has two things. It has state and it has methods that can be invoked that manipulate the state. Okay, so what's shown in the gray box is a state, and these are methods. Okay. And then the way you do this is the standard RMI or RPC-like, where there are stubs which are referred to as proxies and skeletons. Okay, so the client wants to invoke an object, it has to first import the interface. Okay, and there's binding to, you bind to the object, and then the proxy can then invoke a method that basically I'll ask the server to execute that method with some arguments that manipulates the state. Okay. This is what we already know or what we did in chapter 2. Now let's look at all of this in more detail. Okay. So the big difference between RPCs and RMIs, as you remember, is that you can pass parameters as references. In RPCs, you cannot pass pointers, but here you can send object references, and those objects can be, methods on those objects can be invoked remotely. Okay, so here the server side is you have to create the object, okay, then you register it with your naming service, okay, And then from the client side, the first time you invoke the an object reference, you have to contact the naming services or the binder or the naming registry, invoke the import the interface. And then once you have the interface, you invoke the method on that interface. Okay, so stuff that we already know. So now with all that quick refresher, let's now look at how this has evolved and then do the case studies. So this all has its roots in RPCs, as you can probably imagine. This was RPCs were around even before object-oriented programming actually was designed. So there are all these RPC systems that were developed. So this resulted in a system called Korba that was designed in the 90s that uses the notion of distributed object. Okay, and then Java came along, and then people did that sort of reinvented RPCs for this language. It was basically RMIs. And both Korba and RMIs have eventually influenced what are called EJBs, which are widely used. Okay. Korba is used by selective systems, but not a whole lot. But EJBs is widely used in any business application. Okay, and we'll look at EJBs as well. Now, all of these, what the vision of all of these sort of systems was one where you have a large distributed application that distributed across variety of machines, and these machines are all talking to one another. So you get a graph like this where your application has some component running here, some running here, and some running on each of these nodes, and they all talk to one another by remote methods and whatnot. Okay? This is what these systems enable. Okay? But most practical instantiation of the system look like this. Right? So you have a client, you have a server. The server is not one blob. Okay, it has multiple tiers and multiple architectures, but that's all on the back end. So you don't really see this scattered across the internet where all these objects are talking to one another. We have this thing called, the server is here. So this is your server. It's a cluster or it's a multiple machines that just interact with one another. Okay, so the distributed objects are all here. Okay, the client is accessing the server through some simpler interface like HTTP or a browser, and then all of this thing is actually in this part of the picture. Okay, so it doesn't look like that. It basically looks like that in most instantiations. So the one nice thing about all distributed objects is that they are designed to be language independent. Okay, so this is something we did not talk about when we did RMIs. So Korba is a good example. If you look at Microsoft's .NET system, that also has similar features. So what this allows you to do is you can define objects, you can define methods on them, and clients that invoke methods don't have to be written in the same language. They could be written in some other language. The interface allows them to communicate with one another. Okay, so distributed objects by definition are both language independent as well as platform independent. Platform independence we already know. When we did RPCs, we said you could have a server that's Solaris and there's a Linux machine. Can just invoke RPCs. Okay? But it was assumed that the RPC was written in C or C++ or some similar language. Distributed objects do away with this notion. They allow you to define the different pieces of the system in different languages, and they can still talk to one another. So the way they do this is basically what a Korba object handle looks like. So the way you can actually access an object that is written in a completely different language on a different platform is that it basically has this notion of an interoperable object reference. Okay? This basically allows you any language to figure out where the object is on the network, how do you contact it, and so on. Okay? So, and then there is the profile which tells you all the standard stuff, that's the IP address, that's the port number, that's the object identifier, and so on. Okay? So this, think of this as a pointer or a reference that you can dereference using any arbitrary language or platform. And the system is designed to do this. Yeah, and so there are two variants of this. In Korba, you had what are called opaque references. By opaque references, you have a handle, but you cannot interpret it. You just present this handle to a location service and just ask the location service, I want to contact this object. Can you tell me where it resides and how do I contact it? Okay. The location service acts as the intermediaries to ensure cross-platform or interoperability across languages. So you basically use a location service. Now, more recent instantiation of distributed object system, which is Java EJBs as well as CORBA 3 version 3 use what are called transparent object references. In transparent object references, you have something like this where you can peek inside the reference handle and you can actually decode the information there and directly contact the object. So here you can look at the profile and extract the IP address from the handle, the port number and so on. Okay, and that allows the object reference itself allows you to import the interface.
Yep.
So this can be decoded at the client. The location service is no longer needed. You don't need an intermediary for this interoperability. You can basically, so long as you respect the spec and you know what the handle looks like, you can dereference it and invoke methods. Alright, so let's stop here because we run out of time. So we'll continue from this point on and look at EJBs next in the next class. So don't go away. I have project 2 here, handout.